however, is that the Hitler experience was only possible because of group consciousness. Hitler could do nothing without the cooperation and support and willing submission of millions of people, the book says. Hitler seized the moment, but he did not create it. The dialogue says that it is important to understand the lesson here. A group consciousness which speaks constantly of separation and superiority produces loss of compassion on a massive scale, and loss of compassion is inevitably followed by loss of conscience. A collective concept rooted in strict nationalism ignores the plights of others, yet makes everyone else responsible for your own, thus justifying retaliation, rectification, and war. The trilogy goes on, "The horror of the Hitler experience was not only that he perpetrated it on the human race, but that the human race allowed him to. The astonishment is not only that Hitler came along, but also that so many others went along. The shame is not only that Hitler killed millions of Jews, but that millions of Jews had to be killed before Hitler was stopped." Finally, Conversations with God says that the purpose of the Hitler experience was to show humanity to itself. The dialogue makes the point that there is a little bit of Hitler in all of us, and it is only a matter of degree. It argues that wiping out a people is wiping out a people, whether at Auschwitz or Wounded Knee. And I might add here, Kosovo. Hitler was not sent to us. He was created by us. That is the lesson. The consciousness of separation, segregation, superiority, of we versus they, of us versus them, is what creates the Hitler experience. The dialogue concludes, "Hitler thought he was doing good for his people, and his people thought so too. That was the insanity of it. The largest part of the nation agreed with him." The book observes, if you float out a crazy idea and 10 million people agree with you, you might not think you're so crazy. And then the book asks us, who then to condemn? Some critics of Conversations with God have said that the books portray Jews as simply having been liberated from their earthly troubles by the Holocaust, and that since return to the Creator is a joyful experience, there's nothing to complain about. This alludes to your earlier point, and I have heard this comment from others. Yet while the books do state that life is eternal, that death is nothing to fear, and that returning to God is joyful, I do not believe that any reasonable interpretation of the material could fairly portray God as condoning the killing of human beings, or brushing it off as if it were of no importance or consequence. The trilogy does not make light of the acts of Hitler or seek to justify them. It seeks only to explain those acts and the lessons that we all can learn, all must learn, if we are to create a better world.
Dear Neil, in Book 3, page 185, God refers to Judith Shukman as the channel for A Course in Miracles. The actual author channel's name was Helen Shukman. How do you explain the loss of integrity that this error places on your dialogues? RSW on the Internet.
Neil, I'm sure by now it's been brought to your attention that on page 185, Book 3, you've confused Helen Shukman and Judith Scutch. Still, I wonder, sir, how it got so far before it was detected. Was it you or God who made the error? Now, sir, there's no way I can fault CWG or you. But how strange, Judith Shukman? If you or an associate might explain a bit, I would count it satisfactory. Your books are, for me, delicious. I'm a student. Please explain this glitch. Yours, Curtis, Amarillo, Texas.
Thanks, both of you, for asking about this. Actually, I received a number of letters about this, and it's a perfect example of what happens when you don't trust the source. Let me explain. When the material now appearing in Book 3 about A Course in Miracles came through me, I heard the name correctly. But, and I remember this moment so clearly, I questioned myself almost immediately and second-guessed the voiceless voice. I thought I'd heard wrong and that I knew better, so I wrote Judith instead. Somewhat astonishingly, no one at the publishing house caught the error either, until the letters started coming in. Now everyone wants to know how God could have gotten this wrong. And some have gone as far as to say that now they feel that they cannot rely on anything else in the CWG books. For my part, I see it all as perfect. I know now why I was allowed to make this mistake, and why no one at a normally astute publishing company caught the goof either. The error simply points out, glaringly, what I have been saying all along in these books. Do not make this your Bible. I am not infallible, and this material has been brought through an imperfect filter. My continued commentaries to this effect notwithstanding, people were beginning to put far too much emphasis on the perfection of these writings and to elevate me to the level of infallible messenger. Because of the symmetry of this design, I sometimes wonder whether my error was a mistake at all. This error may have been allowed to happen as part of a means of pricking the balloon, bursting the bubble, and telling people yet one more time there is no such thing as the infallible Word of God. Your God, your source of wisdom, will be found within. Do not give your power to any source outside of yourself, not to a book, not to a religion, not to anyone or anything that does not originate within you. For that is where the Holy Spirit dwells, and that is where God will be found, and is where God's Son is once again made flesh, in, as, and through you. Whatever the reason, I have learned one thing on a very personal level. I will never second-guess the voice within again. Well, now we've come to the end of this material, and I want to include one final question that is asked of me wherever I go. I don't recall ever receiving it in a particular letter, but believe me, wherever I go, somebody asks me from an audience or in an interview, how can there be no such thing as right and wrong? Well, I want to tell you that this is one of the most controversial concepts in the CWG trilogy. There is no absolute right or wrong in God's universe, and yet the human mind finds this difficult to accept. Because if there's no absolute right, how can we know when we are on the path to God? By what measure shall we estimate our progress? By what determination shall we know what our actions should be in any given circumstance? How shall we create our laws? What shall constitute our values? And how shall we justify the meting out of our punishments? Not unimportant questions. But you see, the difficulty some people have with the no right or wrong message in CWG is that they assume the book to be saying that we need to eliminate right and wrong from our way of doing things. And they don't see how we can proceed with any kind of orderly society if we do that. Regarding the first assumption, they are mistaken. Regarding the second, they are correct. We cannot, given our current state of development as a species, have an orderly society if we abandon our ideas of right and wrong. Yet the CWG trilogy does not ask us to do that. It does not even suggest that this would be a good thing for us to attempt. Indeed, it does exactly the opposite. It suggests that we hold tight to our values, so long as we see that they serve us. There is the key point. Values are only values, so long as they are value-able. That is, able to be of value. We once thought it value-able to burn witches at the stake in this country, and we did so. Since then, our values have changed, and we don't do that anymore. We may shoot doctors at abortion clinics, and we may electrocute murderers, but we no longer burn witches. So one presumes our society has made a step up. The CWG dialogue says that every act is an act of self-definition. It is precisely through our own choices about what we currently call right and wrong that we define ourselves as individuals and as a society. So the CWG statement that there's no such thing as right and wrong is not an argument for abandoning our current notions about what is right and wrong. It is an argument, rather, for being clear that our notions are precisely that, our notions. They represent our current idea about things. This has nothing to do with objective reality. In other words, it would be inaccurate to suggest that the reason we should make these our values is because they are God's values. God has no values. In the sense that God thinks that one course of action is right and another is wrong, God has no values. He has no preferences in the matter. He does not sit in judgment saying, you did this and I wanted you to do that, so now you must be punished. Repeatedly, CWG makes the statement that your will for you is God's will for you. This is difficult for many people to accept. It means, quite literally, that you may do whatever you wish, without recrimination from the Lord. What we must do to make some sense out of the no such thing as right and wrong message of CWG is to decide to stop using force, spiritual, physical, or emotional force, in our attempts to get others to accept or adopt our point of view on things. What allows us to use such force now, and to do so with impunity, is our thought that, after all, right is on our side, and so we're justified in whatever we are doing to get others to see that. And let's be clear on something, or even this discussion will be bogged down in misunderstanding. The reason for not using force is not that using force is wrong. The reason to stop using force is that it doesn't work. War doesn't work. Fighting and killing doesn't work. Economic blackmail doesn't work. Not for a society which says it wishes to live in peace and harmony. Book 3 makes the point that highly evolved beings, abbreviated as HEBs, living in advanced civilizations, are different from human beings in two ways. First, they observe what is so, and second, they do what works. Among the largest number of humans, observing what's so and telling the truth about it is not common, and doing what works is even more rare. The point here is that HEBs do not have a value system based on artificial concepts such as right and wrong, but rather on what works and what does not work for their health, welfare, and happiness. If we applied such a rule of thumb here, everything would change overnight. In the end, in a book filled with questions, there is only one question that really matters. Everything else hinges on our answer to this question, and nothing else makes any sense until the answer is given. The most interesting thing about this question is that a new answer has to be created in every moment. We can never be through answering the question. And in truth, we should never wish to be through, because if we are, the game of life is over. The second most interesting thing about the question is that we're already answering it. We've never stopped answering it from the moment it was asked, which was the moment of our birth. And we will be answering it until our last day on Earth. And even beyond. Indeed, we have been answering it always, and always, and we will be answering it even forevermore. The question? Who am I? This is the question that God is asking. It is the question that life asks. It is the question that you must consciously ask yourself, and to which you must consciously provide the answer. If you are to jump off, at last, what you imagine to be a karmic wheel that keeps you caught up in experiences which you neither choose nor prefer. Now, I said a moment ago that this is a question that God is asking. Yet that might seem unbelievable to you. How can God have any questions about anything at all? Isn't God the source of everything? All wisdom, all knowledge, all understanding, and especially all of the answers? Well, yes and no. God is the source of all the answers to every question there is, ever was, or ever will be. And God knows those answers will be known by God when God knows them. Clear? Yeah, right. Well, okay, let's go at it this way. God is in the act of deciding who and what God is. Life is a process by which God is becoming. You are part of that process. In fact, you are the process itself, playing itself out. Even as you decide who and what you are and who you choose to be, so is God making the same decision. For God is the sum total of what everything is, and God will be the sum total of what everything becomes. Now, to make matters even more complicated, I should tell you that all of this has already been decided. That is, everything that ever was, is now, and ever will be, is right now. It already exists, has already existed, and always will exist, and it never, ever cannot be. That's why it's impossible for you to die. As explained in CWG Book 3, ultimate reality can be explained using, as an analogy, something familiar to all of us, the CD-ROM. On the disc of computerized games is every outcome that can be imagined. You can sit down and play the game any way you like. You make a move and the computer responds. The response is certain, and it's predictable. Every time you make that move under those exact same circumstances, the computer will respond in exactly the same way. Yet there are an infinite number of possible moves, and therefore possible outcomes, all of which already exist on the disk, ready to be played out. This is a very rough analogy, but it works, in that it helps us to understand how it could be possible for every outcome in the universe to already exist and yet remain to be chosen and experienced. If you think that modern computer technology is incredible, wait until you see the technology of the universe. What remains to be understood is the mechanism by which the game is played. How do we choose and produce our outcomes? And all of that is explained in great detail in the Conversations with God trilogy. If that material is read carefully, you will know and understand how you are answering right now in every single moment, whether you are doing it consciously or unconsciously, the only question in life that really matters. Who am I? Sometimes it helps to get you in the swing of this, to ask the question after rather than before a particular experience or event. Take a look at three things you did, said, or thought today. Ask yourself, is this who I really am? Is this who I choose to be? As you get better at this, you'll start to close the gap between the time you think, say, or do something and the time you ask the question. Soon you'll feel yourself asking the question even in the midst of what you are thinking, saying, or doing. Finally, you'll find yourself stopping in the split second before you think, say, or do something, and asking the question ahead of time. Then you will answer the question by whatever behavior you exhibit. At this point, you will have achieved mastery. Every other question in this book will then become irrelevant, because you will have known yourself, if only briefly, as the creator of your own experience. Once that happens, there can be no more questions. There will only be answers flowing from you every moment, and you will be a master indeed, not just in thought, not just in word, but in deed. And what you do with your deeds will change the world.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this unabridged audio edition of Questions and Answers on Conversations with God. Phoenix Books publishes hundreds of ancient and contemporary philosophical, spiritual, and religious works available in digital audio. And we're proud to be the home of the complete library of Dove Audio, the renowned pioneer of audiobook recordings. Please visit our website at phoenixbooksandaudio.com. As we continue to produce both remastered and newly recorded audiobooks, we encourage our listeners throughout the world to continue to purchase only authorized editions. The UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, "Everyone has the right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any literary or artistic production of which he is the author." Nothing promotes creativity more than successful creation. In a world where authors and artists maintain the right to profit from their works, guarantees a society that benefits from books, music, paintings, movies, and software. All rights reserved, including the right to reproduce this audio or portions thereof in any form whatsoever. To contact our rights department and for all other queries, please email info@phoenixbooksinc.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.